What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. From the back of the book we are discussing today, we have the words, quote, during the past 7 decades, Palestine has been sealed off and shattered into a series of coded areas designed to restrict and manage people's everyday movement, beset by proliferating checkpoints, borders, guard towers, and related infrastructures of containment. The condition of our increasingly walled world calls upon us to grapple with the politics of motion and its ubiquitous visual representation, end quote. Our guest this morning is Rehab Nizal. Rehab is a Palestinian-born multidisciplinary artist based in Toronto whose work deals with the effects of settler colonial violence on the bodies and minds of colonized peoples, on the land, and on other non-human life. She has taught at Dar El Kalima University in Bethlehem, Simon Fraser University, Western University, and Ottawa School of Art, and her video photography and sound works have been exhibited in solo and group exhibitions across so-called Canada and internationally. The book, her book, that we are discussing today is Driving in Palestine. Rehab, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Kat.
It is our pleasure. Rehab, I want to start with a little bit about you. You are Palestinian born. How long did you live in Palestine, and when, why did you make the move to Toronto, Canada, where you currently reside?
Yeah, maybe I'll correct you also. I am now in Montreal.
Okay.
It's okay. I mean, I lived in Ottawa, Vancouver, London, Toronto, and now I am in Montreal. I was born and grew up in the West Bank in Palestine, in Jenin area. When I finished my high school, I received a scholarship from Damascus University. When I finished my studies, I wasn't allowed to go back. So I was stranded between Jordan and Syria, and I had 2 babies at the time. Their father is a Palestinian refugee, stateless, the kids, the babies were. So we were forced to come to Canada. It's not a choice.
2 follow-up questions for you, Rehab. One is, can you talk about being a child in the West Bank, living under the threats and the actual lived experience of that kind of violence? Like, how does your childhood brain make sense of the world under those conditions?
Oh, my God. What a difficult question, because that experience, 17 years that I lived there, they shaped my entire life. They shaped my work even as an artist. It is very difficult. I was a little child when the Israeli occupation forces occupied the West Bank and Gaza in 1967. It just in my memory, the sound of invasion, the warplanes, the house search that followed after 1967, the arrest of my father, my brothers, the nightmare that my mom used to experience when they invade our house and search it, destroying everything, basically, especially her nightmare in the kitchen where they mix sugar with rice, with salt, spill oil on the ground, search every book page by page, turn everything upside down. And stealing photographs, that one of the memories. They will open the albums and pick photographs and take it. And I was observing as a child, like the first time I was interrogated, I was 6 years old by soldiers who leaned down with their machine guns to my level, interrogating me, asking about my brother who was with the revolution. My family is known for resisting the British colonial rule before the Israelis. So we were involved in the resistance as a family. And that's why we were targeted from the very beginning. One of the things that I can't forget, how the Israelis targeted first any means that the Palestinians have to resist. They confiscated They drafted their own law to arrest anyone who has any weapon, any kind. They confiscate them. They arrest lifetime sometimes if someone is trained. It's horrific.
I can't imagine. I can imagine, though, that growing up under those conditions leaves an indelible mark on your mental and emotional health. Can you talk about dealing with the trauma of your childhood as an adult?
It's difficult. However, the community always is the great healer and supporter, I would say, for us as children. And one other factor, whenever I watch the Palestinian children, the Palestinian community across Palestine and in the refugee camps, when I read about their suffering, my own experience, it just shrinks to the corner. It's nothing in comparison of what, for example, the Palestinians in Gaza now experiencing, or in East Jerusalem, or in other parts where they're being displaced, forced out of their homes demolished, children being arrested, interrogated, shot, killed. So it is intergenerational for sure, our trauma. But our strength is we're not silent, because if you're traumatized and silent, you don't resist, then it mounts, it destroys the trauma. So turning the rage and the anger and the trauma into an effective way of expressing ourselves and resisting all these forms of oppression, it helps.
Despite all of that, right, despite growing up under those conditions, despite the lived reality of daily violence that Palestinians face at the hands of the Israeli settler state, you did want to go home after college. Can you talk about why you wanted to go home, and can you talk about the emotional impact? I mean, we know that this is a form of violence, right, that Israel has used, is displacement of the Palestinian people, specifically with the intention of interrupting resistance. Can you talk about that emotional journey for my listeners, please?
I mean, the fact that Israel prevented hundreds of thousands of Palestinians like myself who went to study abroad and they weren't allowed to go back, or went to work in the Gulf countries, then they weren't allowed to go back. I mean, it's in the heart of the settler colonial project, which is replacing the indigenous communities. So it's like replacing me with another settler from the US or Canada or Europe. I wanted to go home because that's my home. That's my family, my olive trees, my house, my neighbors, my community. I mean, of course I wanted to go back. And despite coming here, and I've been here for almost 30 years, it's living inside me, my home. I succeeded, however, as a Canadian citizen, to go to Palestine with a visa for 1 month. And when I entered with the visa, in the way back, I confronted the Israelis about my documents that they confiscated when I left. And I said, I want them back. And it worked. It worked. And I got my ID documents back. And now I am really free to go whenever I want, and my children as well.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Rahab Nizal about her book, Driving in Palestine. Rahab, the book is a series of photos and essays about the impact of settler colonial violence on the lives, bodies, minds of Palestinians. But the photos are not very much of people, but rather of infrastructure like watchtowers, roads, surveillance balloons, etc. Why the choice to focus on infrastructure?
Perhaps it relates to the previous questions. When I returned after 25 years to Palestine, the shock that I experienced, the destruction of the country, the destruction of the landscape, the raising of hilltops and building colonies, raising of the olive groves, building roads for settlers only, the checkpoints, the walls, the all the watchtowers. That what shocked me, the changes that the settler colonial state is implementing on the ground of Palestine. And I wanted to capture this. I started 10 years in 2010. I started taking these photographs while exploring all these changes across the West Bank. And that's only what I was able to move in the West Bank. The moment I got my documents back, I was not allowed to cross the borders of 1948 or to go to Gaza. So I was just allowed to move within 6,000 square kilometers, which is the West Bank only. So why I focused on the infrastructure? Because these are the manifestation of one of the most horrific convergence of settler colonialism with military occupation and apartheid. The three, like you experience those three wherever you go. The watchtowers, the surveillance in the air, the physical ground level, the walls around settlements, illegal settlements in the West Bank, the destruction of the landscape, and I mean the term, I don't want to use it, the landscape, but those mountains, olive trees that overlived states and empires in Palestine, they're being destroyed. So, yes, I wanted to use the photography medium as a documentary tool to portray how Palestine is being turned into a destroyed place, basically.
Driving for folks in the United States is pretty much a benign activity. I mean, unless you're black or brown, and then, you know, yeah, at any given moment, things can go very much awry. But still, most days we are able to drive wherever we want. I'm black, so I'm talking about, you know, black folks without too much concern unless we happen to get pulled over. One of the things that that really struck me about the book was how dangerous it is for Palestinians to drive in Palestine. And I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about that, and specifically something actually I didn't know, and I've been reporting on Palestine for almost 9 years now, is about these color-coded license plates.
Oh, yes, yes. That's one of the features of the apartheid system in Palestine. There is a driving system for Israelis and another for Palestinians in the West Bank. And I'm talking, driving system is different. The roads are different, also segregated. So you have Israeli cars with yellow license plate and Palestinians with green license plate. If you come across, if you come to a checkpoint with your yellow license, you just pass without being stopped. The green one gets stopped, interrogated, searched, delayed. I actually had an event about the book recently, and we talked about colonizing the Palestinians' time as well. You cannot plan to go to your job to arrive on time, or even to a doctor. Perhaps that's where I dedicated the book, to the woman who gave birth on checkpoints because they couldn't reach the hospital on time because of the delay. So this segregated system of driving, driving license, driving documents, and segregated roads, it's worse than South Africa. And our comrades from South Africa indicated to us that they did not encounter segregated roads as we do.
I'm glad that you mentioned the dedication to the women at the checkpoints, because I was going to ask you about that. I thought it was a really beautiful and powerful first few words of the book. We recently, on Tuesday, here in the Bay Area, there was a collective action of tech workers, mostly for Google and Amazon, about Project Nimbus, this surveillance technology that's been heavily invested into by Amazon and Google. And it made me think about your book, and particularly I think it's the final essay, and it's written by you. Rana Nizal Hamadeh. Or close to the last. And it talks about navigation apps, something that we take for granted, right?
Yes.
It's just we put in the address and off we go. Can you talk about the ways in which those navigation apps don't work for you if you're Palestinian?
That is right. And they can put you in danger if you follow the instruction, because they're designed for Israelis, not Palestinians. So I used those. I drove, of course, for many years there. You will hear a warning suddenly that you're entering a foreign territory. It's dangerous. You can't get there. And this message, designed for Israelis, like if you're approaching a Palestinian place, that's where. Yeah. So you're a Palestinian and you're hearing this message and this warning with a sound also. Google have it or whatever app. I didn't use those really. But my daughter, Rana, she lived in Ramallah and she worked in Bethlehem, and she used to come visit me where I was teaching in Bethlehem. She is familiar with these. One of my students made a wrong turn based on these and entered a colony. They attacked him and his girlfriend, and they broke the windshield of his car. They escaped. I mean, just escape. Otherwise, they'd be killed in that colony. Yes, of course, there is a collusion between these high-tech companies and Israel. As you know, and everyone now knows, that Israel actually uses Palestine as a test field for these surveillance technologies. Even worse, in Gaza, they use Gaza as a lab for their weapons. And they marketed as they were proven on the ground. They were used. They bribed themselves, the Israelis, with that.
Given all of this, it makes sense, this other thing that you capture in the book. I wonder if you could talk about the good luck talismans that Palestinians place on their rear view mirrors. What are those and what are they comprised of?
I mean, you know, I'm going to go soon to Palestine, and my sisters are warning me that you won't be able to drive as you used to, because the settlers now are so violent with the current government. The violence unleashed by ministers, like the top ministers in the government. So the drivers, the public drivers, usually they hang these, the holy book, across a photograph of their loved ones, etc., in their cars. It just it just gives a sense of healing sometimes when you look at it. It distracts of what's coming, or while you're standing on a checkpoint for hours. So yeah, a beautiful piece by Ahlam Sharat in the book. She's a Palestinian poet. Of course, it's translated and it doesn't capture the piece as it was written originally in Arabic. But she speaks very well about these gadgets that the drivers use.
Well, that made me think about, right? I mean, like, wherever there has been colonization, and colonization is always violent, indigenous peoples, you know, folks of African descent, Palestinian descent, indigenous descent, we resist, of course, physically with our bodies and our minds. But we've always had a thread of spirituality.
True.
The ancestors, the otherworldly in our resistance. And if you could just maybe say a bit more about the importance of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you noticed in the book, Muhammad al-Kurd, who is from Sheikh Jarrah, from Jerusalem, he's a poet and a writer, 23, 24 years old. He was a hero during the Intifada of 2021, the Unity Intifada. In his piece, which is beautifully written, he speaks about his trip with his mom from Jerusalem to Bethlehem to shop grocery and, I mean, other house objects. So his mom used to tell him and his sister to recite a Quranic verse every time, which is so beautiful. He expressed how he felt about that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there are many aspects that the colonizer will never get, oppressors mm-hmm. will never get. Mm-hmm. Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet, who really I loved his work since I was a child. I remember one of his poetry, a conversation with a soldier. And he ends that poetry with a line that always remains with me. It's like you're holding a gun and you want to steal the land. You want to take the land. You claim you love the land, but you will never understand it. You will never know the relationship with the land, because only the indigenous people know what's their relation actually with that land. It's not about money or extraction of resources, etc.
You are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Rahab Nizal about her book, Driving in Palestine. Rahab, we talked earlier on in the interview about the fact that, you know, once you left for school, you weren't allowed back. But you eventually made your way back as a Canadian citizen. This book is a work that took, you know, you created over a 10-year time span. We've discussed already in this interview about the high level scrutiny and issues, particularly for political folks that are calling out the violence of the settler state. How often did you go back, and what types of difficulties did you face going back and forth?
Since 2005, when I first went as a visitor with a visa, a foreigner, and by the way, there are two ways, one for foreigners, one for Palestinians. And I refused to go with the foreigners when I entered. But I was like, it's a mandatory, you have to go. And in 2005, I lived that segregation at the borders where foreigners and Israelis have a different entrance than the Palestinians. The Palestinians is crowded, chaotic, and the officers are dressed with military fatigue and have their weapons. In the other side, it's a civil with civilian officers who serves you, and in the summer there was air condition. It's just unbelievable. From the moment you get in, you're faced with these features of the apartheid. So the year after I got my children, I went back after I got my documents back from the Israelis. And whenever I could go, I would in the summer, usually. But in 2015, I went for a whole year. During that year, I was working on a project for a PhD dissertation here in Canada. And I was teaching also at Dar El Kalima University, which I returned later on to teach for another 2 years. During that year, I was photographing the Israeli soldiers invading almost every day the city of Bethlehem during the 2015-2016 intifada. And I got shot by a sniper while I was standing alone photographing a skunk truck that sprays awful, horrific lab-made smell weapon, I call it, on the Palestinian homes, on the Palestinian protesters. So I go whenever I can, I would say. But I am going now to teach for a year as well.
Wow. I'm sorry, I got stuck on the fact that you were shot. I'm glad you're okay.
Thank you.
The sheer, I mean, I think the only way that I can talk about it is as I looked at the pictures and I read the essays, was this feeling of weight, the weight of surveillance. It really sat with me as I worked through the book, and in part because there's so many ways, right? It's not like it's just drones or just this. It's so much eyes in the sky, right? Constantly watching and watching with promises of consequence if they catch you doing whatever they deem to be the wrong thing that day, breathing perhaps, right? You inhaled the wrong way. And I wonder if you could just talk about the weight of that on the day-to-day psyche of Palestinians.
My God, I mean, such legendary people, I'll tell you, the Palestinians. I lived it. I mean, I lived it where you don't have a sense of privacy, a sense of security, a sense of safety for one single night in your bedroom, in your living room. An invasion can happen anytime. Now, the surveillance, as you said, it's not just physical on the ground or from the sky, electronic as well. Like you would read about a poet, a young woman poet, who published poetry on Facebook. She was arrested. And they arrested her for 6 months without charge. So how is life? I would go back to my first comment about what helps us in our traumas, which is the community. The community support each other. And there is a way of dealing with this surveillance, 24-hour surveillance from all directions, electronic and physical. They find their way, really, the Palestinians. And like, I'll tell you, in 2021, after the Israeli attack on Gaza, and I wanted to go to Gaza since many years, and the Israelis refused to give me a permit, even when I was working in the university. They refused. So I was paralyzed of the images of children being killed in Gaza. So I decided to go through Egypt, through Rafah. And I did go after 1 week of that attack in 2021. It all was fresh, the destruction, the trauma among the children. But I didn't see any of the rockets that I read about, huge rockets that destroyed buildings and towers. And I asked, where are these? And I was told the following. The next day, or hours even, after each attack, each strike, the Palestinians collect, the resistance movement, collect these, and they recycle them, and they send them back. So I really was amazed of how they find their way, because Gaza under siege, no metal is allowed to get in, nothing, absolutely. So they find their way. You cannot work above ground. They have tunnels underground. In the West Bank, they too have their way of dealing with this situation. In Jenin, you probably heard lately what's happening in Nablus as well. They kill one, there is another 10 who come and take his place or her place.
One of the ways, Rehab, that those of us in the United States that consider ourselves allies or accomplices with Palestinians in their fight for, in your fight for liberation, right, is to call out and push back on the millions and millions and millions of dollars the United States government gives to the Israel settler state. And so I got curious about Canada, because that's where you live. And I did a little bit of Googling. And it looks like Canada also gives millions and millions and millions to the settler state. And I wonder if you could just talk about the relationships between those two. I mean, I won't call it Israeli settler state government, but between Canada and Israel, I guess I'll say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, many prime ministers, conservative or liberals, they would always emphasize the shared values with Israel. And I smile every time I hear it, because they do share values. They're both settler colonial states established over the ruins and the destruction and the dispossession of the indigenous people, of course. Now, Canada is complicit in the Palestinians' suffering since the very, very beginning. The foreign minister of Canada in 1947, Mr. Pearson, he's the one who drafted the partition plan. He's the one who convinced the Latino American countries to vote to guarantee the resolution in the General Assembly. It's from the very beginning, Kat. It's not new. Now, it's more evident with the conservative, who they don't hide their Zionist tendency at all, especially during the Stephen Harper taking over the government some years ago. He signed agreements with Israel, economic, military, security. He himself now, he's not a prime minister anymore, but he works with former Mossad employees, director, and CIA. They established a spying company here in Toronto. Now, the Zionist lobby in this country, in Canada, it is powerful. The number is not as in the United States, but it's powerful. And it pours money to the government and to Israel as well. So, yes, we have a strong Zionist lobby influencing the government and having channels open with Israel. There is 5,000 at least Canadian settlers, illegal settlers in the West Bank. And that's in violation of international law. That conflicts with, at least by appearance, they say they're against the Canadian government, against settlements. Yeah, it's worse even sometimes. I see it's worse than the U.S.
You mentioned earlier, and I, of course, took note, that these essays, many of them are written both in Arabic and English. Can you talk about that choice?
I wanted the book to be accessible to Arabic speakers to Palestinians, and it is my first language. I really wanted to be an example, like, to whom do we write and what language do we use? When I taught in Palestine, there's so many things happening because the liberal economy, of course, is invading the West Bank. You could see how English language is affecting so much students. Like, if you want to communicate with the world, you have to speak English. Your own language was nothing, basically. It doesn't enable you. So, yes, I am pushing my native language into the forefront, or at least equally use it with the other language.
One of those essays by Christina Battle talks about listening to rather than looking at the images. And I think for me, part of why that resonated, because the way that I very much experienced the book was through feeling it. You know, yeah, I'm looking at it, but like each image had with it its own texture, feeling, emotion, weight, that I also found incredibly powerful. Rahab, who did you write this book for, and why this book now?
It is necessary. I wrote it for everyone. You know very well how the Palestinian narrative is suppressed in the West. So my experience, my narrative, I am putting it in this document for everyone to look, for everyone to see. And sometimes I think of the Canadians who convert to Judaism, and I know two, by the way, converted to Judaism and became Zionist, and now they live in the West Bank. While working on the book, of course, this is not a factor, but one of the factors that you're building a life over the ruins of other people. That's one thing. The other, how many years it took us to convince the world that there is a system of apartheid in Palestine, in occupied Palestine. Just recently, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, just recently the world began to understand, yes, there is an apartheid system there. So for me, what are the manifestation of such system? Here they are, like, compiled together in this book as visuals, if you want evidence. And you know the traditions of documentary photography, which all oppressive powers, by the way, they're against documentary work, photography or film, because it exposes these regimes, these forms of oppression. They would like you to go work virtual reality or whatever, yeah, of course, but which is more fictional, I consider reality in here. So, yeah.
Gosh, you know, when you said that, and this will be my wrap-up question, and it's not a fully formed one, though, but when you talked about, right, how long it's taken to convince the world that there's an apartheid happening in Palestine, I think, you know, about here in the United States, right, and that people are still in denial that there's a genocide happening of Black folks, to Black folks, by law enforcement. And that's despite the fact that on any given day there is a video of some Black person being murdered by law enforcement or a vigilante or a security guard. And that has led to this, like, massive debate, right, inside of the Black community about, like, do we need to keep putting these images out of what I call nigger porn for white people to convince them that this is happening, or is there another way? And I won't talk about where I land on that issue, but you could have just as easily, to your point earlier, put out a book of dead Palestinian children.
That is true. And I have a self-published book previously about the Palestinian youth resisting, actually, the slingshots, bodies in motion. No, but this is for the infrastructure specifically. It focuses on it. But you spoke about, yes, when non-whites suffer and struggle and decades and hundreds of years, how long it takes for the world to see, to recognize, and the indigenous people, for example, in this country, in Turtle Island. Just recently, the bodies of children in the residential schools being revealed, the issue. The black communities in the U.S., and here, by the way, not just in the U.S., how it resonates with us when George Floyd was killed. The image was very effective, Kat. The image of George Floyd, the guy who documented that moment, it really was effective. But it resonated in Palestine that in the Israeli apartheid wall, several artists, within days, they painted monumental murals of George Floyd. We are connected together. Blacks, indigenous, racialized, all these oppressed groups around the world.
Yes, we are. I mean, folks often talk about, you know, when the Ferguson rebellions were happening and that Palestinian comrades sent information about how to deal with tear gas. That actually happened here in Oakland in 2009 when we were in the streets behind the execution of Oscar Grant. It very much does feel, it very much is true that our liberation struggles are connected. And that's part of why I believe that we will eventually win.
Very well.
You all have been listening to Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today has been Rahab Nazal. Rahab Nazal is a Palestinian-born multidisciplinary artist based in Montreal, whose work deals with the effects of settler colonial violence on the bodies and minds of colonized peoples, on the land, and on other non-human life. She has taught at Dar al-Kalima University in Bethlehem, Simon Fraser University, Western University, and Ottawa School of Art. And her video photography and sound works have been exhibited in solo and group exhibitions across Canada and internationally. Her book that we've been discussing today is called Driving in Palestine. Rahab, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Thank you. Wish you all the best.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.